This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
يجعل للشيطان على انفسهم سبيلا. اولین درخواست من امام رضا از شما اینه.
Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, the eighth Shia infallible imam, in a beautiful hadith asks people not to let Satan find mastery over them. This sentence means not to open any way for Satan to enter your soul. Satan deceives people in their own ways. For instance, Satan does not deceive an old man through sexual pleasure. Instead, Satan will go to youth to trap them in sexual pleasures. Or, for example, Satan does not invite a chaste woman to adultery or prostitution. Instead, Satan invites her to do backbiting. Satan cannot deceive a faithful person by inviting him or her to drink alcohol.
گفت منزل آیت الله عظمای بروجردیه کسی رفته بود منبر همم علما نشسته بودن
In a story we read that once there was a ceremony at the house of great Ayatollah Burujerdi in the city of Qom. The Sheikh on Minbar started talking about the impacts of drinking alcohol. Now all the audience were pious people who never had experienced drinking. One of them, in a joking way, stated, "The Ayatollah will stop drinking alcohol. That's enough." This means that Satan will not start deceiving an Ayatollah by drinking alcohol. He will enter through a different way. However, Satan can deceive scholars and learned men by arrogance and boast. Or Satan can deceive the youth by making them lazy at the time of morning prayer. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasim Ali Himani and Sheikh Qasim. Assalamu alaikum to both of you and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about a big question, and that is the compatibility between religion or religious beliefs and science. As we know, most of the scientists are concerned with the objective findings. For example, throughout the history, the objective sciences, which are done in laboratories or are done in the field of study or something like that. As we can find in the religious studies, you know, we are mainly concerned with the divinity or with the divine, the supernatural powers, with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and all this. At the first glance, it might look that there is no compatibility between religious beliefs and science or scientific beliefs. The main thing is up in the minds of the people, especially of the 21st century, who are, as you can see, busy with different materialistic things around. And the case is that they expect the science to answer all their questions in terms of their body and their mind, you know. And they do that. But when they get to the religion and religious beliefs, they say, this is something ancient, this is something archaic. We cannot, for example, expect a religious belief who was revealed, for example, at least 1,400 years ago to solve our problems today. What's your answer to that?
Actually, you know, I think the problem is even deeper than that. You know, nowadays we are encountering a new phenomenon called new atheism or, you know, the scientific atheism. Unfortunately, this type of atheism, actually we had the atheism throughout history. But that one, you know, the old one was normally a sort of philosophical or a metaphysical atheism.
We got even Church of Science today.
Yeah. So that one was, you know, normally based on philosophical argumentations or refuting scientific philosophical argumentations of the other side. Mm-hmm. But this one is a sort of, you know, as you said, the worshipper of science, or the, I know they call this trend as scientism. So they sort of, you know, believe that the only thing that could be confirmed and could be understood as a real thing is what that be, you know, observed or experimented upon. So this is unfortunately the problem that we have nowadays, and they are sort of dismiss all sorts of metaphysical or supernatural things that might exist over there. So I think there are a number of answers or replies that we can actually provide them with. One of them is that even though that they may claim that they are sort of evading metaphysics and, you know, things that are supernatural, but they themselves, you know, when they are talking about science, they are presuming, you know, and they have many assumptions based on metaphysics. For example, the logic that they are using that is completely metaphysical, you know. You cannot prove logics by experiment, you know. That's based on the way that human being thinks. And you know, and there are many actually presumptions and assumptions that are using in new sciences, even though that they try to dismiss all sorts of, you know, metaphysical.
Isn't it because of lack of understanding or recognition of the power of Allah and divinity? Because I've heard some of these new atheists and these atheists, you know, who are very much nowadays, if you Google it, you know, they are really active on the world. Say, we do not understand divinity and the supernatural powers, but at least we can be successful understanding the materialistic world around.
No, the problem, as I mentioned, the problem is the way that they approach towards things, you know, and they call it the philosophy of science. So the foundations that they are laying out there in order for, you know, acquiring knowledge, the only foundation to them that could be laid out is just, you know, the observable foundations and whatever that could be experimented.
So
if you talk about something supernatural that is beyond natural, you know, nature, so that is nothing to them. You know, that's you're talking nonsense. So the first step that we have to take encountering these people is, you know, to break this foundation that they're making. You know, the way that they approach the world is not limited just to natural things. This naturalism that they are talking about, sometimes they call it, some of them, to our surprise, some of them may even believe in God, you know. But they say the way that we approach science must be just materialistic. So they call it methodological naturalism.
That's all right.
But I don't see that. How can they go on, you know, with their belief in God with that methodological naturalism? So if you ask them, how do you believe in the miracles? So, you know, you're a believer. We have these people. Let me just name one of them. There's a famous person. Actually, he used to be an atheist, but he converted to Christianity and he became a theist, Francis Collins.
Yes.
A very famous person, book of, you know, The Language of God.
Yes, yes.
And so, you know, this person is a methodological naturalist. But, you know, I'm wondering how such a person can answer the miracles that happened, you know, by the hand of prophets of Allah, prophets of God,
yes,
you know, throughout history.
So some of them some of these atheists through their, you know, experiments, could not find the answer to so many questions and find this complexity, for example, of the brain, of the mind, of the galaxies around, okay? And at last, they believe in the superpower.
No, actually, more fundamental than that. First of all, the presumption that science can answer all our questions and, you know, in our day-to-day life. Look, there's so many questions that science is still not aware of. It just can't find an answer to it. For example, where did the first single cell come from, right? There is no answer to it. You Google it, you go to NASA, you go to any university, look for that answer. They don't know the answer. And they say it very clearly. We don't know where the first single cell came from. Okay. They have many theories about it, but none of them really fills that gap. They still don't know where the first cell came from. Point number two, about the dark matter, they're not able to come to a conclusion what the dark matter is all about. If that explosion happened with a mini difference, nothing would have come into existence. So how come that precision took place at that time? They have no answer to that. More than that, let me tell you, actually, you know, if you just give it a little thought, you will realize that this theories that they have come up with, the Big Bang theory and the evolution theory, this is nothing other than religion. Look, when you talk about science, we say science, all the actions or the experiments that you do, either they are observable, and then you should be able to recreate them in your lab.
Yes.
Right? And then the results should be same. And when that happens, then you call that science. All right, great. Look, let's look at evolution. Who observed it?
Okay.
No one observed it, right? Can you recreate it in
your
lab?
You're talking about Charles Darwin theory now?
Yeah, I'm just giving you an example that why science is actually not science, and it's basically a faith system that they're believing in, and then they turn around and question the religion. We say, okay, evolution. Did you observe it? No, we didn't observe it. All right. Can you recreate it? No, we can't recreate it because it takes a long time. Fair enough. So now you can't observe it, you can't recreate it, and you are not sure that it'll give you the exact same results, right?
Yes.
So then how do you believe in evolution? We have signs in front of us. What signs? We saw the bones of dinosaurs, we saw the skeletal
structure, the fossils,
and blah, blah, blah. All right. Okay. And based on the science, we believe in something called evolution. Well, that's what religion is all about. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, look, you're not able to find me. You're not able to believe in me. Look at the signs around you.
Yes.
Look at the signs and believe in me. And that's what they're doing. They're looking at the signs of all these fossils around them and then believing in something called religion. So this is basically a belief system. Where is your empirical data here? Where is your positivist approach here that, look, this is what it is? No, you can't recreate it. You can't observe it. So basically that is also a faith system, but they have some data in their hand and they want to call it science and they question us for believing in something based upon science.
When we get to the text of the Holy Quran, we can find the story of the creation and Adam and Eve, you know, with the creation of the world. But the case is that sometimes I myself believe that the believing people around the world, including the Muslims, expect the Holy Quran to answer all the scientific questions. And this is not good, I think. I mean, from a book of the guidance, you expect it to answer your daily questions, your routine life questions, okay? Of course, there are so many laws over there, Islamic rulings over there, you know? But the great thing is that, you know, I think you are taking it wrong. You are taking the wrong way and you are taking the wrong path. The case is that the scholars of the Islam during the history trusted in the Holy Quran, the prophetic tradition and ahadith, the infallible imams, their conduct. At the same time, they did not stand still. They researched and studied a lot, and we can find it in the life story of so many of the scholars.
Correct.
A new world because of the basira, because of that, you know, light that were into their mind and heart,
the
was open to them.
That
yes. And this is the true enlightenment, I think, the enlightenment from inside, not the 18th, 17th century enlightenment of the West. Putting religion aside, and then everything will be lightened for you. Isn't it, Sheikh Hassan?
Yeah, actually, I believe that, you know, going back to that compatibility or mm-hmm. incompatibility of religion and science, you know, we may say that, you know, even though that with respect to science, we're not always sure, and that actually they themselves say that we are not trying to be, you know, certain about things. We are just, you know, try to sort of judge about our hypothesis based on the evidence that we have. So, you know, what I understand is that, you know, we're not actually forced to sort of see that there is a sort of, I don't know, a sort of independence, relationship between religion and science. Because mm-hmm. they normally say there okay. are four types of yes. relationship that you may, believe
okay.
Existing between science and religion. This is compatibility, okay. incompatibility, dialogue, and independence.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, some religious people, they think that it's a sort of independence relationship between okay. these two. I don't believe so. I believe that there is a dialogue where even there is a sort of, witnessing from both sides, you know, to the other. So, for example, we nowadays, actually, since maybe 40 years ago, up until now, we have some scientific evidence for, approving and confirming the God hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. Recently, there has been a French book, you know, by Michel-Yves Ballore and Olivier Bonacieux, you know, about 1,600 pages, you know, God, Science, and Its Proofs, Advent of a Revolution. It was written in
yeah.
French. This is the bestseller book, you know, and these
yeah.
two outstanding scholars.
And it's not just that book. Yeah. Actually, there are many okay. other books. There is another book, The Return of God, The Return of God mm-hmm. Hypothesis,
yes.
written by Stephen C. Meyer.
Yes.
Actually, we have this fine-tuning argument for the existence mm-hmm. of God, which is okay. one of the very beautiful, you know, evidences
yes.
or arguments, new arguments, another, a renovated way of, you know, argument from design,
okay.
actually, which is so beautiful. And it's actually using there are three, four premises.
Yes.
In the first premise, it's using the quantum physics, cosmology,
yes. Yes.
and giving some evidence that the whole world is finely and, you know, so strictly fine-tuned in order for life to exist
okay.
over there. And then in the second premise, it talks about, you know, probability theory and, you know, evaluate the hypothesis that could explain those fine-tuned, you know, constants of physics or natural laws and things like that.
Yes.
And, you know, consider all those hypotheses. And then at the end, the result of that argument, it reaches to this result that the best explanation, actually they call mm-hmm. it the IBE, the inference yes. to the best explanation that mm-hmm. is used nowadays in science, is the design hypothesis. So,
correct.
You know, we see that, you know, even science can not only
yes.
not being in conflict with religion, but also confirming and giving more force to,
okay.
you know, religious teachings.
Okay, thank you very much. We are done for today's discussion. We are out of time. If you got any final remarks, we got about 1 minute, Sheikh.
Well, I think in just last 1 minute,
yes.
I would say that let's keep this misunderstanding aside that
mm-hmm.
religion and science are incompatible. While
okay.
Islam has been promoting knowledge and research
yes.
and scientific development. So look at it as a subset, science being a subset of religion, because
mm-hmm.
religion deals with two dimensions. And
yes.
People who feel that religion is not supporting science
mm-hmm.
Is a misunderstanding, is a misconception. People can get into science and be a professor and be an innovator or be a scientist and continue to be a monotheist. And
that's all right.
There is no contradiction in it. So I am actually, I hope many people,
mm-hmm.
youth particularly,
mm-hmm.
get attracted towards science
okay.
and go and do research and all that while remaining on the path of Sirat al-Mustaqim, inshallah.
That's all right. And which one is more important? I mean, having knowledge of your very matter or your soul, you know, and you have a world within yourself as the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you have to discover it more and more and to find where is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and what is the place of divinity inside you. They can, I can find the center of the world and the galaxy, inshallah, in you yourself as a human being. The best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay, thank you very much, Shaykh Qasim and Shaykh Qasim Ali Himani. It was very kind of you to be present in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this program and on other episodes of this program, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Subject, Roots of Differences of Values in the World. Today, thank Allah, we are faced with two groups, both of whom are valuable. A group of teachers of the nation throughout the country, of course a group of them, and also a group from the Red Crescent Society. The value in the world differ based on doctrines and based on opinions. With the study of doctrines, which exist in the world and the religions of the world, we can understand that values differ in religions and also the ideas differ. If you overlook the monotheist and divine doctrines and refer and study the materialist doctrines and the ideas behind materialism, we will notice that these two doctrines are opposite to one another and different from one another.
But
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. And I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islamic Revolution. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that in the path of a revolution and for its victory, offering sacrifices and being sacrificed are inevitable, especially a revolution that is staged for God, for religion, and the deliverance of the oppressed. Now, in this part of his speech, Imam Khomeini is basically talking about the sacrifices which are being given. Obviously, we need to pay some cost in order to gain something. But even though when someone gives his life in the path of Allah, which is being said in the Quran, fi sabilillah, in the path of Allah, he sacrifices himself for a greater cause, for the cause of Allah, for the cause of religion, and the true religion, which is the truth, and to overthrow the oppression, and to be with the oppressed ones. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi. When we look at this cause and when we look at these sacrifices, it looks very little. Obviously, this cause is to bring justice, and this justice will remain forever in this world. And if the people will have the same mentality from the beginning of the revolution till the day they are there and the generations, and they pass it to their generations, this everlasting revolution, which is connected to divine, which is connected to God, will bring justice in the whole world. And it becomes the cause of bringing justice. The people, the other nations, will take this nation, this revolution, as a role model. And therefore, we can see that we have seen many revolutions, many uprisings in other parts of the world. We can see that. Why? It's because of the Islamic revolution. It's the blessing of Islam. It is because this nation, with its revolution, has gained its pride. It has come out of the umbrella of a system which is known as capitalism, which was a system of oppression, which was the system of injustice. And therefore, when someone raised for God, God give him a high rank, the rank of being martyr in his path. And this is the win-win situation, that if you live, you enjoy this revolution. And even if you die in this path, you are a martyr. And there is a bigger reward in hereafter waiting for this martyr.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Economic divide.
The U.S.-NATO onslaught on Russia and the premise that Russia will invade Ukraine has brought to the fore political and economic dynamics, including energy, which has sent Europe scrambling, caught in the crosshairs of the U.S. militaristic approach towards Russia. Hi, I'm Omidor Shandil, filling in for Kaveh Tafoyi, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at how all of these scenarios can play out and whether this will really lead to U.S. isolation. Russia playing the gas card over the standoff on Ukraine. How Europe may cope if Putin shuts off gas. Around 35% of the European Union's natural gas comes from Russia. Meanwhile, European gas and energy prices are hitting through the roof. Then there's the issue of trade between Russia and Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Will Russia use the energy card to push for continuing trade between Europe and Russia? How will Europe cope or reject the U.S. on this, especially if sanctions were applied on Russia? Then comes the impact of war and sanctions on Russia. World energy prices like oil and gas will be affected, including food, metals, and manufacturing. Even the U.S. will be affected. Import of Russian oil have hit record high, despite souring tide.
Tensions are on the rise between the West and Russia over Ukraine. The U.S. and its allies accuse Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine.
I mean, I think we're looking at potentially the most significant conflict that we have seen since World War II. When you look at the kind of composition, the size, the capabilities that Russia is building up on Ukraine's border, it suggests that they're preparing for a relatively significant invasion scenario where they could possibly, you know, encircle Kiev and take half of eastern Ukraine. That's something we haven't seen in decades.
But Moscow has rejected the invasion allegations. The heightened tensions between the two sides has also had a huge economic impact on the involved parties. Ukraine says the panic created over Russia's alleged planned invasion is hurting its economy. Ukraine's economy is already in crisis mode. It needs as much as $5 billion to stabilize. Its currency, the hryvnia, has dropped 8.4% against the dollar. This is one of the worst performers worldwide since November, when Russia again massed troops on the border. The simmering tensions has negatively affected Ukraine's economy. Figures show that tourist arrivals to Ukraine have never recovered since the conflict first started in eastern Ukraine back in 2014. Foreign direct investments have also failed to rejuvenate since 2014. But the crisis is not limited to Ukraine and will stay there. Europe has a lot to lose if an actual war breaks out. European consumers are already paying higher prices for their energy, including gas and electricity.
President Biden, but also even more importantly, European allies, could figure out a new strategy on energy to try to gradually, but more quickly, reduce dependency on Russia, Russian oil and gas. Unfortunately, it's not going to help this year very much, except that if Putin knows that we're thinking about doing that, it creates more credibility that if he moves into Ukraine, that we will retaliate.
In Washington and European capitals, voices are getting louder for a comprehensive sanctions regime against Russia. The U.S. Senate is working on unprecedented sanctions against Moscow. EU countries have also threatened to follow suit.
Of course, it's very important to underline the principles of OSCE, as Ann Linde mentioned. And of course, we are preferring that the EU coordinates this kind of answers well, and EU countries have as unified views and opinions as possible, and this work is ongoing, of course, in Brussels.
Social media posts on the Russia standoff have been wide and far-reaching. This is probably the most extreme case of the world turning bipolar. The U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, tweeted, "It is Russia that has to make a stark choice. De-escalation and diplomacy, or confrontation and consequences." One viewer had this response posted from the Russian President Vladimir Putin, albeit sarcastically, but maybe to the point. Moving on to the more important and life-threatening issue of energy, Europe is stuck in a quagmire. Europe doesn't know what it will do if Russia cuts off its natural gas supply, this tweet says. This viewer poses a serious question for the U.S. If Russia cuts off Europe's energy, the U.S. says it will help Europe with Middle Eastern energy. Okay, but that energy was already bound for China. How do you help Europe without hurting China? You can't. Biden can't think even one move ahead. We have a couple of questions of our own. How can the U.S. guarantee energy to Europe? Where will the U.S. get its oil? Let's not forget, 11% of U.S. oil comes from Russia. Joining us in this segment is Stanley Esrol, an activist at the LaRouche movement. Stanley, welcome. The standoff between Russia and the West, i.e. the U.S. and the EU, has taken on a new dimension. Russia appears to be playing its energy card to assess the situation if and once U.S.-led sanctions are applied. What will Russia do if Europe goes along with the U.S.? Or will Europe probably back down and tries to maintain its ties with Russia, especially on energy?
Well, you have to realize that this is not what appears to be a struggle between the United States on the one hand, Russia on the other hand, and some people might think that Ukraine is important in that struggle. But, you know, recently the Ukrainian president and others in the Ukrainian government have been saying they don't see any particular problem with, or difficulty with anything that Russia is doing. They think that Joe Biden is blowing it up out of all proportions. And the fact is that what we are up against is a global crisis, which is not a human rights crisis. It's not a crisis on, you know, how the individual rights of various people are being protected. It's not a crisis of who controls Ukraine. It's a crisis of, does the global financial network have control anymore? Do they? And this is something that has been building up really since the end of the Second World War.
Now joining us is Tim Kirby, a radio host and political commentator. Tim, welcome. Here's where things get a little crazy. There's a lesser known fact, and that's the issue of Russian crude exports to the U.S. U.S. reliance on Russian oil hits record high despite severing ties. Now, why then would the U.S. shoot itself in the foot by acting so crazily and aggressively toward Russia, not to mention the rest of the world?
Okay, well, first off, it's impossible to really cut off Russia's energy exports entirely. Europe can cut off the exports to Europe, which will, of course, have an effect on the Russian economy. But there's the whole rest of the world, and there's a big rest of the world. We have to also remember that the sort of economic center of the planet shifts more and more towards Southeast Asia every year, which also means they have their own energy needs. So it would have an effect on the Russian economy, a negative effect. It's really been believed that all that the Russian economy has is oil and natural gas, okay? That's it. And if we look back to the sanctions policies going all the way back to 2014, it would seem to prove otherwise. You know, when the Soviet Union got sanctioned,
well, this is our info news section of the program where we review some economic news that we deemed important from around the world. Our first time is a look at inflation. How many times have we warned about this to plague the world, really? Starbucks, the ones that make coffee, announced we are forced to raise prices due to inflation and supply chain issues. At the same time, the company's profits went up 31%, and the CEO got a 39% raise. That sounds like companies are rebranding corporate greed as inflation. Moving on. Did you like the name Meta or Facebook? Well, Facebook has lost market share big time. It saw its biggest stock market loss of over $230 billion, also a record daily loss for a U.S. firm. Its shares fell 26.4% after quarterly figures disappointed investors. It makes you wonder how a name could be a game changer for the bottom line. Moving on, $8.4 trillion. That is how much tax-dodging billionaire dynasties could cost the U.S. The wealth hoarding by ultra-rich families would be equivalent to over four-coat Build Back Better plans, according to this report. This would happen over the next few decades, citing loopholes like estate and gift taxes for the rich as the reasons. Now, our final look is at Canada. It lost 200,000 jobs in January, and the unemployment rate
rose to 6.5%. This was because of the lockdowns and the mandates. But a lot of unwarranted blame is leveled against the truckers. Food services and hotels were among the hardest hit, with young people and women most affected.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is the in-depth section of the program, and for this section, we want to take a look at the impact of this crisis on Europe, then the world as a whole. First up, a look at the Russia-EU trade balance, in particular, EU exports and imports to and from Russia. EU exports about 89.75 billion euros, and when it comes to EU imports from Russia, that figure stands at 170 billion euros. The question that comes up here is whether Russia will use the energy card or not when it comes to Europe. Let's look at the temptation. First, a look at energy. Russia was the largest exporter of natural gas to the European Union in 2019 and 2020. The figure standing at around 35%. You can call this a good leverage, wouldn't you say? Secondly, there are concerns that Russia could be using this crisis to lobby for the newly completed Nord Stream 2 pipeline to come online by not sending more natural gas for Europe's storage. Nord Stream 2 is a major supplier of gas to Germany. Now comes the role that the U.S. is playing, a dubious one. The U.S. is desperate to increase its market share of natural gas. And what better way than to demonize Russia, then move in to replace Russia as the main supplier to Europe? The former U.S. President Donald Trump made no bones about that, even though he didn't name Russia by name.
Giving new meaning to the expression alternative energy, President Trump today told Europe's leaders that the United States is more than ready to be the continent's alternative energy source. An alternative, that is, to Russia, who the president suggested has used its energy dominance in the region to hold it hostage.
Let me be very clear about one crucial point. The United States will never use energy to coerce your nations, and we cannot allow others to do so. We are sitting on massive energy, and we are now exporters of energy. So whenever you need energy, just give us a call.
We are committed to securing your access to alternate sources of energy, so Poland and its neighbors are never again held hostage to a single supplier of energy.
Now, when Trump talked about alternative sources of energy and how the U.S. can replace Russian gas supplies to Europe, he was talking about fracking or shale gas production, something which the Russian president slammed. Now, let's have both of our guests rejoin us on this. First, to Stanley Ezrael, activist of the LaRouche movement. Stanley, there is the issue of trade between the EU and Russia. The trade between the two is quite vital. Now, Europe is Russia's biggest trade partner. It actually accounts for 37.3% of the country's total trade in goods with the world in 2020. Obviously, there's not a strong desire for either Europe or Russia to have this trade stopped. Is Europe diverting from the U.S. on Ukraine for its own sake?
Not at all. And we are seeing that there are a number of leading people in Germany, in France, in other places, people who are experts on the economy, who have publicly pointed this out. The United States trade with Russia, you know, whichever way you go, whether it's, you know, U.S. to Russia, Russia to the United States, is 3 to 3.5%. Russian trade with Europe is, as you pointed out, in the range of 40% plus. So the United States, who is pushing this, has really nothing to lose by cutting off trade with Russia. Europe does.
Now, joining me is Tim Kirby, a radio host and political commentator. Tim, what do you think? the U.S. not to have that much to lose, as our other guests stated. And now, if that is the case, what can Europe do in order not to fall victim economically to U.S. warmongering toward Russia?
Well, again, this is a demonstration that, on the one hand, Europe always seems to be very united against dictators, in quotes, from other countries. But then when push comes to shove, they all want to work with said countries. And this is the perfect example where, despite sanctions that the European countries vote for, all the big businesses go around them. The sanctions really haven't changed that much. There are still plenty of European-owned factories operating in Russia. There's a lot of interchange between the countries, or goofy ways of getting around all these sanctions by selling something to Belarus, and then the Belarusian sell it to Russia, or through Switzerland, or whatever. So even from the very beginning, if Europe was really, really deeply believed in this narrative that Russia is somehow this evil aggressor who's going to come and destroy them, their actions would be radically different.
Russia supplies about 30% of Europe's oil and 35% of its natural gas, which would be cut off in the event of conflict and possible sanctions. An actual war would significantly push up energy prices.
Considering that Europe is facing an energy, or better to say, gas crisis right now, making the long-term contracts you mentioned is significant.
Analysts believe oil prices could reach nearly $125 per barrel, with gas prices following higher.
Consequences for the energy market would be likely would be a further increase in prices of oil and natural gas, and therefore of energy costs more broadly for many countries in the world.
Furthermore, sanctions would surely complicate an already complex situation over Nord Stream 2, which is set to supply Germany with much-needed gas. Sanctions against Russia will badly hurt its economy, but would also be costly for the U.S. and the EU.
Ich würde schon sagen, dass Europa abhängig ist von russischen Gaslieferungen, aber wir importieren ja auch Öl und Steinkohle. Das ist sicherlich richtig. Auf der anderen Seite würde ich aber auch sagen, dass Russland noch sehr viel abhängiger ist von Europa, weil ein Großteil der Einnahmen in Russland durch die Energielieferung fossiler Energien kommen. Und sollte das wegfallen, würde Russland sich massiv ins eigene Fleisch schneiden.
Russia is a key producer of agricultural products like barley, corn, sunflower, and rapeseed. Sanctioning Russia will likely increase the prices of these commodities.
In terms of headline inflation numbers, that certainly could keep headline inflation much more elevated for longer. Of course, we are hoping, like all of the international community is, that there can be a peaceful resolution to this issue.
Other key ingredients that the EU countries import from Russia include ammonia, potash, urea, and phosphates. Manufacturing supply chains also would not be immune from either a conflict or sanctions against Russia.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping and the Russian President Vladimir Putin met before the Chinese Olympics kicked off, and they displayed their anti-US stance in full force. The meeting between the two leaders was unprecedented in the message that both sent to the West, in particular the US. They unveiled a global alliance with an anti-US theme. They both condemned certain states' attempts to impose their own democratic standards on other countries. Another issue they addressed covered their bilateral trade and the US dollar. Although this has been addressed by both before, this time was different since the political atmosphere was different. They announced the need to expand their bilateral trade in national currencies due to the predictability of the US dollar. This comes after the US threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars due to US sanctions in the event of an alleged Russian invasion of Ukraine. Militarily, the two countries pledged to cooperate more while strengthening their military alliance. And here's where China displayed its support for Russia against NATO. Both opposed NATO expansion and accused the US of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. There was an announcement made by the Russian president regarding energy, which also appeared to be a slap in the face of Europe when it came to their dependency on Russian gas. Putin announced a new deal to supply China with 10 billion cubic meters of natural gas from its Far East region, the largest such transit of gas in the world. But when it comes to energy, there is one obvious supplier that Europe can look towards, and that is Iran. If Europe wants to show good faith, especially in the Vienna talks, it can do that by having Iran provided with its energy needs. Iran has the second largest natural gas reserves in the world, holding more than 17% of global discovered gas fields. That does it for this section of the program. We look forward to getting your messages.
The U.S. is dead set to push Russia into a corner. But why? European countries are realizing that may not be in their best interest, like France and Germany, who don't want a war in their own backyard. Even the EU has realized this, which may explain why EU and France have called for a European army to not be subservient to NATO. But the U.S. has literally shot itself in the foot. Russia and China have aligned themselves against the U.S., while European countries may not be so keen to follow in the U.S. lead. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. I've been Omid Roshanda, filling in for COVID. Please write to us and let us know how we're doing. But before I say goodbye, a word for the Europeans, in case you forgot. Iran has a lot of gas. Oil, too.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this segment are founded in the Holy Quran and in the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon him and upon his family, supplemented with scientific data and facts. Joining us in the studio is a guest speaker and Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, dear listeners, we'll be talking about mistake number 9 some parents make when raising their children, and that is the parents having different and clashing parenting techniques. Dear Sayyid, what can we do in such a situation, and can we fix it?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir la'in rajim, bismillahir rahmanir rahim, Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajah. Now, this is a very common issue that we have today. And that's when we see parents, they themselves, don't have a vision themselves for upbringing their children, or at least agreeing on one method to educate or apply in a place for the behavior and the values for the children.
Right.
So you see, for example, the father, he has something in mind that he wants the child to apply, and the mother says, no, he should do this. And the father says, no, he should do that. Right. Now, obviously, I'm not saying in one specific situation, but in many situations, you see the parents, they do the opposite when it comes to their kids.
Right, because they have different opinions.
Yeah, which actually creates a big confusion in the child's mind. He doesn't know which one is right, which one is wrong.
You're just like the previous mistake we told about
exactly. Same thing when it comes to having right. that contradiction in values.
Right.
And the reason why this happens, this fight between parents not agreeing on one specific thing, is the fact that with parents, you see that their ideology when it comes to certain things is completely different.
Right.
So sometimes you see some parents taking a hardcore approach to things, and you see mothers taking a lenient right. approach.
A soft
or one, sometimes right. it could be vice versa. The idea is when you have such a different mentality and different ideology, for sure, the mother and the father, they're going to have a problem. Now, unless the mother and the father can sit down and agree on a way to discuss right. things and figure out things, then they're going to create a very unsafe and very turbulent environment for the child, where he will not feel safe at all.
Right.
Well, he will not have any self-confidence at all. Now, even, for example, the parents, for example, need to agree on the fact that if I say something to my child or to one of the children that you don't find suitable, at least don't say nothing now.
Right, in front of
later
the child.
Later on, tell me, and I can change it myself if I find out that I'm wrong, without having to get the child to feel that there is a problem between me and you.
Right, and with that, let's go ahead and take a break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the problem of having a different and clashing parenting technique with your partner. Dear Sayyid, please pick up where you left off.
Therefore, you are saying that if this happens, if this different of opinion happens between parents when it comes to upbringing their children, it's going to affect the child greatly, because then he can't tell which one is right and which one is wrong.
Right.
Who is right? Is it the mom or is it the father? And at the end, ultimately, the child will choose a side,
right.
whether it's his father or his mother. He will take one side.
Right.
And that's a problem in itself.
Of course.
That when a child moves towards only one of the parents. So we don't want that to happen. And also that having that fights between parents, it also affects the child as well. So therefore, we have to, as parents, as mother and father, we need to make sure that we keep our differences and our mental ideology away from the child. And sometimes we live this contradiction and this fight between us. Even though I don't think me and my wife, this doesn't happen to us. But for example, when a father says to a child, okay, it's time to go to sleep. And the mother says, no, give him 5 more minutes, give him an hour, give him half
right.
an hour. Well, there you go, that's a clash.
Right.
And the child says, okay, who should I listen to,
there's
the
a
mother
conflict,
and the father?
Yeah.
Then I'm going to choose a side.
Right.
Obviously, this suits me, therefore I'm going to go out with my mom.
And just to say, if I may touch upon a point that how this will affect the child when he also is grown up, is whenever he will think of a marriage, this is the image that he has of the family picture. There's no unity, there's no teamwork. And I think naturally he will abstain from such a societal construct of the marriage.
Yeah. So that's the idea. And the biggest mistake that sometimes we make is that when I get into an argument with my wife, or we don't agree on something, and especially when it comes with the children, we try to bring the, each one of us tries to bring the child to his side.
Right.
Try to convince the child, okay, you know what? No, I'm right. The one says, no, your father's always wrong. He says this is not right.